Just you wait.
Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew. How do you like that intro there?
I like it a lot, actually.
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah. It kind of came out of nowhere. I didn't know what to expect.
I saw the look on your face. You're like,
this guy
has an intro.
I like this.
Because I have a tiki theme to my...
Okay.
I used to. It's really weird that, you know, how podcasts evolve over time.
Right,
you know, like when I first started this, it was all about, had a Hawaii theme to it.
Okay.
I actually used Hawaiian music in the background.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And my studio at home is kind of decorated Hawaii with bamboo and Hawaiian pictures.
We don't have that here.
We don't have that here.
No.
Matter of fact, what we have here is Echo.
Yes, we do.
That's actually what we have here.
We're at the edge of a volcano.
Yeah. I'm sitting here with comedian Matt Holt. Matt, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Now, for the people that don't know, you know, my listeners may not know.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Okay. I'm a Midwest guy. I'm from Indianapolis, land of, I don't know, but that land of me. I've been in the business. I've been in comedy for 17 years. I started in 99. And... loving the week in Wichita with you. First time we've worked together.
This is. It's been nice. Yeah. It's been a good week. It's nice to actually be in a condo with somebody that you don't want to just close the door and never see till showtime.
And that's pretty normal to have that.
It's
very unusual to be able to click with somebody that you're living with for the week.
Have you ever been at a comedy condo where you divide up and then pass each other in the kitchen but don't even speak?
Yeah, I've... Luckily, there are fewer condos today than there were
five years ago,
even. So you don't deal with that as much, but it's pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah. Let's find out about your start into comedy. Now, I talked to you the other day about this, and you mentioned the Brad Garrett connection.
Okay, yeah.
So I'd love to get that story for the podcast.
I'm happy to do it. Okay, so in 1990, even before that... turning 21 for me was important, not because of drinking, but because I would be old enough to go to a comedy club. Because in Indianapolis, you had to be 21 to get into a comedy club.
Yeah.
I think now you can be 17 or 18 in some places.
Yeah, they do a lot of those underage shows. Just mark your hand.
I could not wait. I wanted to see live comedy more than anything. It's what I wanted to do from the time I was probably 5 years old. And so I got married at 20. At 21, we made plans to go... To the comedy club. So I went to a couple shows, and then all of a sudden, I was from Indianapolis, so I grew up listening to Bob and Tom. Well, Brad Garrett was on Bob and Tom every time he was in town, and before I ever got to see him live, I heard him and I kind of knew about him, and it was like, this is a guy.
I want to go see this guy for my 21st.
Well, he wasn't even my first comedy show. It was just that once I was 21.
Oh, and you're going to
the next
club.
Time he came, I was going to go.
Okay.
So we went. And, you know, you've obviously seen Brad. You know Brad. The show opens. They turn all the house lights up, and he just walks around and just fucks
with
everyone.
Works the crowd,
and it's amazing. And I fell in love with it. And we started going multiple times a week to see Brad, you know. And there were times we'd go Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday to a show. And you started getting some recognition because he'd realize these people have been here. And we weren't weird
these
about it.
These are stalkers.
Right, yeah. But so then you'd go to the lobby and you'd hang out in the lobby after the show. And Brad was never selling anything because he's a terrible businessman at that point in time. Never sold anything.
At that point in
at
time,
that point,
Brad.
Yeah. So he, we kind of start talking. And then through that, we kind of had a connection. And so we come to find out he was going to be in Las Vegas working Bally's when I was going to be in Las Vegas on vacation. So I'm like, wow, that's cool. We're going to be there at the same time. He's like, well, you should come to my show. Come to the hotel, call my room, and I'll get you set up with tickets. So we go to Vegas, and I contact him. He sets us up with tickets. We go. He's opening for the Righteous Brothers.
You never close your eyes anymore.
And the thing about it was, at the time, I was 22, maybe 21, 22 years old, and I was too stupid with music. I didn't care about the Righteous Brothers.
What?
Then I saw them live and they blew me away. It was really a great show. But Brad takes us backstage after the show. So we're hanging out backstage. Bobby Hatfield's there. You know, he's backstage with us.
Yeah.
And like Bobby Hatfield just sang backup on Springsteen's Human Touch album, and I'm a huge Springsteen fan. I was losing my mind. I'm one degree away from my idol, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So we're having this great night, and Johnny Thompson, the magician that worked Jubilee in Bally's, he was there with his wife, which is his assistant, and he's doing up-close magic for us and everything. It was just, it was such a cool night. I get excited.
It was almost surreal for you?
Very surreal. Well, and like, but at the time, this is very telling. At the time, Brad had said that he had an idea for a comedy club. He's like, I want to open a comedy club. I want to open it in Branson, Missouri.
Woohoo!
Because there's no comedy club in Branson at this point in time. There may be now. There's comedy theater, I think. And he was like, you know, and he gave the whole concept. And immediately, these people were like willing to just invest money to help him make this club
right there
happen.
On the spot.
Yeah, they're like,
what's it going to take?
You need money? What do you need? And so then Brad's telling these show business stories, you know.
Wait,
and
tell the idea for the
concept.
Club.
Okay.
The concept for the club.
So the concept for the club, he was going the stage was gonna be a pier, like a dock,
uh-huh.
coming out from the land, and all the tables. He wanted the front of the table to look like the front of a boat,
uh-huh.
and then the table lamp would be a lantern, like hanging on the boat,
like the bow of the ship,
yeah.
boat,
yeah, like a little rowboat kind yeah. of thing. And he wanted the club to be called Fishing for Laughs. Now,
I like it.
It probably would have worked. I would be interested to know if, after all these years, if Brad remembers that or not. I remember because this ended up being the most important night of my life.
Yeah, but, Brad, do you remember?
Yeah, I'd love it if he's listened to this. So, he's telling us, I'm listening to all these different show business stories, you know, and I'm a fly on the wall. I don't belong there. You know, I'm just a guy from the Midwest. And it was a great night. It was a fantastic night. So at the end of the night, he's escorting us out of the backstage area to get us out to the casino. And we're walking through. And by the way, I had told Brad before, like we were hanging out playing golf back in Indianapolis, and I told him I wanted to be a comic. He was the first person I ever told I wanted to do stand-up. And as we're walking out of Bally's, we come across the back room or the backstage area, and he looks out, and all the linens have been pulled off their tables. So, you know, like in Bally's, they're just plywood.
Yeah, just
you know?
Cheap plywood.
Yeah,
they disguise well.
Right, right. So he looks at me and he kind of, I'll never forget this. He stands there with his, you know, 6'9" frame, and he takes this deep breath and closes his eyes. Very Zen moment kind of thing. And he goes, man, this is when I love to come in this room. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, look out. He goes, all the glitz and glamour has been pulled out of here. Like, this isn't a pretty room. Like, this room's not better than you. Like, as a performer, this room can't defeat you. You have to have that mentality to succeed in this business.
Because you're looking out at plywood tables.
Yeah,
so it's not that strong of a room.
Right. It's really kind of an ugly look. You know, it's barren and it's just not crisp, you know? And he's like, and you want to do this for a living. And I said, more than anything. And he's like, all right, I want you to experience something. And he puts his arm around my shoulder and he pulls me out. He has me close my eyes and he kind of moves me around and he puts me into a spot. And he's like, all right, I want you to stay where you're at, but I want you to, you know, turn your head toward the ground, but keep your eyes closed.
Yeah.
And so I do that. I would have done anything he told me to do. I mean,
I want you to take your pants off.
Whatever you want, Brad.
And poop right here.
Let's do it. I was already pooping a little bit, so it didn't matter. So he steps away, and he goes, okay, when I say now, I want you to open your eyes, but keep your head down. I'm like, okay. So he goes, all right, open your eyes. When I open my eyes, my feet are standing on the star in Bally's in Las Vegas on the stage. And he goes, in that spot where you're standing right now, Frank Sinatra stood, Johnny Carson stood, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, all the greats occupy the space that you're in right this second.
Ooh.
And it gives me chills when I tell the story even. And he goes, now, I want you to lift your head. I want you to look out to where the audience would be sitting. And I looked out and he said, do you still see the same ugly plywood tabletops? And I honestly didn't. I said, no, I don't. And I just saw light. You know, I can't even explain what I just, everything looked so bright and clean and polished. I mean, it was just.
Go toward the light.
Yeah.
Go toward the light.
And he goes, don't you ever forget how this feels. And it was the end of the night. And he walked, and he was so kind and walked us out. And I left and I went back home. And then, you know, he came to Indianapolis the next time and he was like, hey, I want you to do 5 minutes tonight in front of me. And I'm like, I can't, I'm not ready to do that. And he's, come on, just Just do it.
Do 5 minutes. What's 5 minutes?
Come on. So I agree. I'm like, okay, but...
But you've never done it before.
Never done any comedy at all.
This would be your first 5 minutes.
Yes.
And you, Brad Garrett wants you to do it in front of him.
In front of him.
In front of a
sold out crowd, yeah. Chicken Patties, Broadway Comedy Club. So I show up at the club. I have not told anyone in my party that this is supposed to happen. And about 20 minutes before the show, we're sitting in our seats. And I'm like, I got to get up. And I walked and knocked on the green room door. And Chick Parent opened the door. I was like... I got to talk to Brad, and he's like, okay. And I'm like, Brad, I can't do this. I'm just not ready. Like, I'm going to embarrass myself. I'm going to embarrass you. And at the time, I understood what an opportunity it was, and I was going to ruin that.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I can't do that. And I thanked Chick for allowing me to have 5 minutes. I thanked BT, who was the feature act that week, for allowing me to have time. And I said, I just can't, I'm not ready. And Brad goes, okay, when I come back, then you be ready, no bullshit, and you go up and you do five. And I go, fair enough, because he was there about every 8 or 9 months at that point. I'm like, fair enough, no problem. And so then we did our normal thing where we had a couple drinks after the show and hung out or whatever, and then he left. And then the next thing I know, he got Everyone Loves Raymond.
And so he wasn't coming back.
He never came back to Indy. It took me 7 years to get on stage.
You missed that window of opportunity, and 7 years later.
I know.
Oh.
I know. And if I've given a lot of thought.
Just say. Sure. Okay, go ahead. I thought there was going to be a glitch in the recording.
Oh, okay.
There wasn't. But, okay. So 7 years, let's just jump ahead. 7 years later then. How did you actually finally get on stage? What was the moment that sparked it?
Well, what happened for me was I had gone through a divorce. So my first marriage had ended. I knew that going into it, I knew that I couldn't start doing stand-up when I was in my first marriage because there wasn't the support to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that I never would. If I would have stayed married, I would not be doing comedy. So I became single. And when I went through that, I was looking at, okay, what do I really want out of my life? You know, because I'm married 9 years. I'm divorced now. I'm just at 30 years old. And I kind of get a do-over. Like, what do I do? And I married young, you know, so. Yeah. And what did I really want out of life? And what I always wanted to do is try comedy. So I started going and watching the open mic in Indianapolis, where I was living. And I watched about 4 months every week. And then I finally put my name on the list. I'm like, I'm going to do this. And I went up. And first time I did great. I mean, I had a really good 6 minutes.
That very first time.
First time was pretty good. And then after that, I just kept going up as much as I could. But that was it. It was like, okay, I can do anything I want. And it's funny. I always kind of had that situation with Brad in the back of my mind, like having that push.
Well, and seeing that table that can't defeat you from the start.
Absolutely. And I tell that story in my shows. I'll close my show a lot of times. If I have a crowd that I really like and I really connect with, I'll close with that story. And I use it as a motivational story, telling people, and I might even do it tonight, but I tell people, so whatever you're doing in your life and when you go after whatever your dream is, just ignore the plywood tabletops. And it's a really cool message, you know?
Yeah. So, well, it's very Vegas. It's very old school.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, like, yada, yada, yada. Ladies and gentlemen, before I leave tonight, let me tell you a little.
And I'll tell you what, my goal, I mean, obviously my goal is to work. I want to work Vegas because I think I have the mentality for Vegas. You know what I mean? But, like, I learned from Jimmy Pardo, who was a big influence on me when I started out. Jimmy was a guy who, his closing joke was a funny joke, but it wasn't the funniest joke of his act.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I'd asked him one night, I go, your closer is, and he goes, not as strong as the rest of my act. And I go, yeah. And he goes, why? I asked him, I go, why? And he's like, I just performed for 55 minutes to an hour for these people. All I'm trying to find a way is to say goodnight. And that's how I say goodnight. So I use that story as a way to say goodnight to people.
Now, see, my version is I want to do my biggest, strongest, boom joke. So it's like throwing down an electric guitar at a concert.
As you're leaving.
Good night, everybody.
And I totally get that. I think there's a lot of value in that. I think it just depends upon what kind of performer you are.
Yeah.
You know, you're a very, very high energy. You grab everyone's attention from the moment where I'm more of a wise ass and I build and I take away and that kind of thing.
And it's been a great show this week.
Yeah, it's a good mix.
It's been a good mix. It's because it's a nice, and everybody's walked out this week, not walking out of the show.
Right.
Leaving the showroom after the show has been like, you guys were great. We come here all the time. This is the best show we've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a good mesh.
So it was nice. But why do you think Jimmy, I'll pick your brain for that. Why do you think he uses that to say goodbye? Instead of what makes people think I should just leave on a low note? I mean, if you know it's not your best joke, why do you want to bring it down before you leave? Like, wow. I really enjoyed that.
To be fair with Jimmy, I don't know that he closes that. I know he doesn't use that same joke to close now. And he probably does something a little bit different now. Yeah. But I think that, Jimmy's a crowd work guy. Like, he does a lot of crowd work off.
I used to work with Jimmy a lot back in the Chicago, when I did Chicago days.
Jimmy's brilliant because what Jimmy can do is he has such great recall. So, like, he can have 9 different people in the crowd that he's talked to, and he can remember their name, what they do, what they draw, whatever he's talked to, he remembers all that. So I think that his show is that. You know, it's so impressive. And I think it's hard, I think as a crowd work guy, what is that big closer?
Yeah.
Because so much of your show was the crowd, and I think this is a good, it's a good way
now, that to makes, dis- now, that to makes dismount, sense.
You know?
That makes sense. Because, I don't know if you noticed my 2 shows last night. One, the first one was basically material.
Yeah.
And the second one was a lot of crowd work.
Yep.
And then closing with material. Like, I got him. I padded you into a ball. And now let's roll.
And they think, the crowd thinks that you're still doing crowd work, but you've worked in the material because you brought them along.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a skill that a lot of people, I'm a crowd work guy, and the people that can't do it and try to, it's painful to watch.
Very painful. I don't understand. Because guys watch, that's one of the reasons, and this is not to toot my own horn, but it was one of the reasons that I was good at radio is because listening is the skill. It's not about what you're doing or saying. It's listening for a cue word, something that you go, oh, I'll play off of this.
Whatever.
It's not just trying to go, where are you from? What do you do?
Yeah,
that sucks. Get a real job. You know that.
No, bad crowd work is the worst thing in comedy to me. You just want to say to comics, if you're not good at it,
don't do it.
Don't do it, because if you do it poorly, it's really bad. I'd rather see a bad joke than bad crowd work.
Well, one of the things that I noticed a lot today is, in the past, you see a lot. I saw genuinely funny people. I mean, genuinely funny, not just. I can only say the words that I've written down. You know what I mean?
Right.
And by genuinely funny, I'm talking about guys that can crack a joke and just be personal.
Yeah, good conversational.
Good conversational. Yeah. Not just walking with their little pad and getting on stage, and it basically sounds like you're reading your Twitter feed.
Right. Right. Well, like, you know, in the last 2 years, I've changed my style. I've become a lot more personal on stage, and I'm more story driven than because I used to try to just say funny stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so now I talk more about my life, and it's great because I never forget my act.
Never.
If it's real, I never worry about someone stealing my jokes. I never worry about any of that stuff because it's my life.
Yeah.
And the biggest compliments that I get after a show is when people leave and they come up to me and they go, "Wow, you're so comfortable and natural on stage." That's what I think comes with being a good listener and being a good conversationalist. Like, when you look on, remember the old Tonight Show, the best guests were the ones that did great panel.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
they used to be just panel.
Right.
You know, they would come out and panel. It wasn't about and perform your new song, now come over, sit down. Right. Now come over, you know.
Right.
It was just, hey, what have you been doing? I haven't seen you. It's been a year since you've been on the Tonight Show.
That's the stuff I like. You know, I like that. And so I guess when it comes to comedy, I'm definitely more old school than my peers. You know, like when you were talking about it's very Vegas-y or whatever. Yeah, I'm more like that. I think that it's the show business thing.
Well, you can see people that I think you comedy is evolving. It's always kind of like, I remember when I first started, it was very much like in threes. You had to do thing in threes.
Yep.
Everything was in threes. Right. You know, hey, what if the Beach Boys were a punk band? I think their songs would sound like this.
Right. That was very formulaic.
You know, what if cockroaches could talk? I think it would go like, you know, there was that kind of comedy. And then it became more observational, and then it became more one-liner-ish, which it came back to, I should say.
Yep.
One-liners were always big. You know, my wife hit a deer. It was in the zoo. Ooh. You know, those kind of jokes. So those kind of came back around. And now I think storytelling is kind of big. The actual, you know, like these moth where they go up and just tell stories.
Yeah.
But I think what's missing in a lot of that is actual jokes in the story. Because I watch some of the newer guys and I go, nice monologue.
Exactly. You know, and
nice speech.
I run a monthly storytelling show in Indianapolis called Speakeasy, and it's strictly storytelling. And the reason I started that show is because in 2014, I wrote my first one-man show, and I was telling all these very personal, heartfelt stories that were just bare nerve, you know?
Yeah.
I'd never said those things in front of an audience, so I started this storytelling show so I'd have a place to go and say this stuff for the first time when before it really mattered. And we've now been doing it for 2 years, and it's because The Moth is so popular and that kind of thing. And our show is... it's not as pretentious as The Moth is, because I've been to a few Moth events and like they're scored and you know their rules and all that. We don't. Our rules are just make sure the story is true, don't use any notes, and don't go long. That's it, you know. And I think you're right. A lot of comics they just get up and they ramble at a show, not at a storytelling event, but at a comedy club.
Yeah.
And they have no point. They have no premise. They have no punch, and they have no point. And you're just like. Yeah, that's a fantastic.
That was great.
Just diatribe you went on.
Right.
That's no one's laughing.
There's like if you read a good book, every once in a while there's going to be a punchline to go with
something.
Something pays off along the way, and then there's a payoff in the end. Mm-hmm. You know. But a lot of times I watch these guys, and I'm just like, so you told us a story about getting high and going to 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
And I didn't get anything from it other than the fact you got high and went to 7-Eleven.
And those are the same comics that will tell you all the time, well, I just did 25 minutes. You talked for 25 minutes.
Yeah.
You did not entertain for 25 minutes, and you didn't get laughs for 25 minutes.
Yeah, I won't say the name of a comic, but one guy came up to me after a show. I'd had one of, you know, a really good show. One of those shows you were telling me about when you finally, you know, you feel it. You feel the energy in the room. And he goes, how much time did you do? And I go, I did 45 on that one. And he goes, oh, I could headline. And I go, what? He goes, I've got 45 minutes. I could headline. And I go, there's a big difference between doing 45 minutes and headlining.
Absolutely.
I go, I could stand on stage and say nothing for 45 minutes. That's 45 minutes.
Right.
There's a big difference. And I don't think people realize that it takes an actual skill.
Absolutely.
To be able, it's up and down. You take people on a little bit of a ride.
Yep. Well, you have to embrace silence. You have to understand silence is a tool.
Yeah, a dramatic pause pays off big time.
Really does, and especially even more so when something's not going well. If you have a crowd and they're just not going with what you're doing, rushing it doesn't help. But if you just live in that silence, live in that vacuum for a little bit, and then let them know, oh, he's got this.
Yeah,
he's not rattled. He's done this before.
Yeah, we're not smelling blood off of him. We didn't take him down. The pack didn't take him down.
And if
I see so many guys, like you said, they talk faster or they talk loud. Mm-hmm. Loud doesn't equal funny.
Right. Yeah, I have this kind of this. I haven't done it much this week. I don't do it as a feature, because I believe that the feature shouldn't really talk to the crowd. You know, the feature shouldn't do crowd work. The feature shouldn't do. There's certain things that you shouldn't do in the middle spot. It's just not the way it works. But my normal show is I kind of have this little bit of an attitude. It's almost kind of Rickles-like, but I'm not insulting people so much, but I'm a little better than them. And I make sure they understand that.
I think I'm slightly better than you.
Because I'll say stuff on stage like, you guys are a great crowd. You know, there's 6 or 8 you could take off and it wouldn't hurt my feelings too much. And they get it because they know it's coming from a good place. And when that works, then I can do about anything I want. I get away with a lot on stage just because... It's just that little turn of attitude.
Yeah.
But you see younger guys that we're talking about that do that, and they come off angry and bitter, and they're people like, what's wrong with this guy?
Yeah. Well, it almost as though people might prejudge in a way of like, who does this 20-something think they are?
Right, absolutely.
You have no life experience to talk to me at all, shit pile.
That's exactly right. That's a great way to put it. That's a great way.
You have to have some type of experience or explain to them that you've had experience. Even if I'm not saying that immediately a 20-something should be judged.
Right.
But if you tell a story about yourself and get you a certain point of what you've done and where I've lived and where I've worked up to and this is where I am today, then people go, oh, well, I get it. But when you just walk out with an attitude, they're like, fuck you.
Well, think about this. Last night, our late show last night, which and they were both crowds were great last night, but our late show – That crowd was average age 40.
Yeah.
Maybe older, but at least 40. A 22-year-old comic going up and talking about the tribulations of their life. Most of the people in that crowd last night are like, you're out of your fucking mind.
Tribulations?
I have had twice as many hardships as you.
Yeah, I worked 3 jobs. Yeah. I've worked, and you're up here talking how hard it is to live in your mom's house.
One of my biggest pet peeves, I used to run an open mic. I ran an open mic for 8 years, and I was pretty strict about stuff. Like, you didn't go over your time and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And when a guy would go up and it'd be like his first or second time, he's like, you know what I love about being a comedian? You're not a comedian. You're not a comedian.
You haven't done this yet.
Yeah, you are open miking. You are not a comedian. Please do not do that.
Do you know what I like about open miking?
Yeah, something. You know, or like.
Or how many times you heard somebody go, oh, you're a comic? Do you know such and such? They're a comic. No, they're not.
Right. I have.
No, they're not. I've seen them twice on open mics. They haven't done well, and they still have a day job.
Yeah, I just had that happen in the last month. I just ran into someone, and they're like, oh, you probably know my friend so-and-so. He does.
He's
like,
a comic.
No, he's not. No. I wouldn't put him on stage. And that drives me crazy when that happens. It's just like, no, not really.
Well, I read an article not long ago about the new comics, the attitude of it. It's like when I started and you started, it was pretty much your goal was to be a comic.
Right.
Their goal isn't to be a comic. A lot of these, they're just the goal of having fun. That's what this article is like. Their goal isn't to eventually sitcom or movies. Mm-hmm. Their goal is to just have fun.
Yeah, there's been a big change in the last, I'd say, year or longer, where there's a whole society of comics that all they do is they go from festival to festival, and they just perform in these, they don't get paid. They just do like 5-minute spots in festivals where there's no industry, there's no goal from it.
They're entertaining their peers, right, and themselves.
Yeah, and they've all paid $25 or $50 to submit, and then they get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go across the country, they put themselves up in a hotel,
yeah,
or a hostel or whatever. And then they do their 6 minutes, and then they hang around and they network with other people who aren't working. It's like,
but they go, you should come to my town. We've got a great little show over at this bar.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And I've, you know, like, there are some very quality festivals that aren't, I mean, obviously Just for Laughs is like a great festival,
right,
but that's not something I'm going to get into.
The Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Yeah, all that stuff. I'm not going to get into that with, because I don't have representation. I don't have credits and that kind of thing. I'm a guy on the road, you know, doing what I do.
That's one of the reasons I think they should, and there's a new comedy app. I'll back this up a little. There's a new comedy app coming out.
Oh, cool.
And one of the things that they want to do with this comedy app is let people discover new comedy.
Oh, that's great.
That's one of the goals of this app, is because, you know, they're talking about the big guys you get everywhere. But part of the fun of, it's like when you discover an indie band. You know what I mean? Like, I love this band. Nobody knows who they are.
Right. Stuff we talked to music this week about that.
Right.
Like, we like all these performers that no one's heard of.
Yeah.
And it's great when you have that in your
pocket.
And
that's sort of what this app wants to do, is help turn people on to great comics that you've never heard of.
Oh, that's great.
And that's one of the way I've described myself for a long time, is the funniest comic you've never heard of.
Right. Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm like, yeah, you've never heard of me. I'm not on anything. But when you come see me,
yeah, and how many times you get people leaving a show going, why don't you have a show?
I know.
Why aren't you on a you should have your own sitcom.
Well, people don't understand how it works either. I mean, my own sister had said to me one time, we're at a function, and she's like, you know what you ought to do? You should go on Ellen. I'm like, well, fuck yeah, of course. I'll just call her.
Yeah, I'll just walk there, knock on the door, and say, my sister said I should be on Ellen.
And she's like, you should do Vegas. Like, I never thought of that. Thank you so much. Let me pack my bag.
Well, you should contact Brad.
I have done that.
But you didn't. I know that you did. Mm-hmm. That's why I kind of brought this up.
Okay.
But you contacted him and to say, hey, thanks, all this kind of.
Yeah,
you didn't say, hey, is there some way I could do a guest set or get into your club?
No, you're right. I didn't, because I didn't want. That's a fair statement. The reason I didn't do it is because I didn't want him to think that me reaching out to him had any ulterior motive. It truly was to thank him.
Which was a really nice thing to do on your part.
I mean,
it is. It's a thank you for sending me down the right path.
Yeah, you basically inspire me to go after what's the most important thing in my life. And to talk business at that point in time to me would have just been arrogant on my part and just inappropriate. So that's why I didn't do it. And he's from what I know, and you know, you've certainly told me stories, and my other friends that work for him have told me stories. He's maybe the kindest man in the business.
He seriously is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. For a star?
Yeah.
I mean, somebody that can't walk through a room without people mobbing him.
Yeah.
He is one of the nicest person. And his girlfriend, Izzy, is just as sweet. I mean, they're like this wonderful little couple, you know?
I'm ecstatic for his success because we would, in Indianapolis, we would talk all the time about how he was... He just couldn't figure out like what it was going to take to get over the hump for him, you know? And I'm like, someone's going to figure it out. They're going to find out a way to get you on TV, and then you're going to be unstoppable.
Well, Bob Fisher, who owns the Ice House in Pasadena, Bob and I were talking last weekend about, he said this, he says it to me all the time. He said it years ago. He actually gave me a bottle of champagne on stage. He came on stage, handed me a bottle of champagne in front of the room and goes, this guy is going to be a major star.
Wow.
And I've you know, his words never made it to God's ears.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You saw the champagne?
But so I don't know what takes you to the next level. So this is what Bob and I were talking, because like he goes, 20 years ago, I swore you would have been the next the next comedy star. He goes, you know, when you did Star Search and Evening of the Improv and all those shows, it looked like your train was about to take off. And I go, I know. I don't know what.
Right.
So what got us talking was, he goes, I need to start a company called Next Level. And he goes, it's where we just figure out how to get people to the next level.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes. So maybe some stunt that gets you in the press. Something that makes it go viral.
Right.
Just come up with little things, you know, like. And
that's a good idea. I mean.
Just because something takes you to the next level.
Yeah.
It's not by accident or whatever. Something just clicks and takes you to the next level.
Yeah, and obviously with Brad, it was Raymond, you know, because he had a pilot that didn't make it, and a few other projects. But I remember he was telling us a story. This is so great because on the off chance, I don't know if Brad listens to your podcast.
I'm going to send this to him. I will.
If he listens to this, he told me once a story about how he had a meeting with, I think he said it was the ABC. This is before anything, you know. He had a meeting with ABC, and it was for an idea. He had an idea for a show, and I probably shouldn't be saying this, but it's probably fine. He had an idea for a show called America Works. This is before reality TV, by the way. And it was a show where he would go around to people who had interesting jobs.
Kind of like dirty jobs?
Kind of like that, but it was like two examples that he gave me about it were like, he'd go to a bathroom attendant in a nightclub or whatever, and then go to their house to see if their colognes were arranged in the bathroom the same way, you know?
Yeah.
And try to make that funny.
Is their bathroom as nice as the bathroom they work at?
And then there was another one that, like, you find the guy that runs the press that stamps the M on the M&Ms. And you interviewed that guy or whatever.
Yeah.
This is all pre-reality TV. And it's pretty mind-blowing when you look and see where we're at now and know that there's an entire network that's devoted to this kind of programming. And he said that he was in the meeting, and the ABC guy said, I think it was ABC, said, well, I don't like the idea, and I don't like you. And his response was, well, what do you really think? And then he left. But so those are things
we don't like the idea, and I don't like you.
And I don't like you. So those are, we talked about that stuff all the time, and he would always lie to me and tell me he was going to be on Larry King. He's like, yeah, I've got to get ready. I'm doing the Larry King show while I'm in town this week. I go, really? What time? What night? He's like, Tuesday night or Thursday night, whatever. And then I'd go to the show. I'm like, and see you on Larry King. He's like, yeah, it didn't happen. I'm not on Larry. Like, he would listen, fuck with me all the time because he knew I was also a fan, you know?
You were a gullible fan.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. But like, he sent me Casper shit after the Casper movie came out. Like, he sent me the talking fatso.
Yeah. I auditioned for that movie, by the way.
Did you really?
Yeah. That's when I was living in LA and actually had a really good agent and management. And I auditioned for one of the...
Really? One of the ghosts?
Ghost voices, yeah.
So I remember, because I was so tied in, because that was a first thing that Brad got, was he got Casper. You know, he had two stupid dogs and he got Casper. And when he got Casper, like, I remember still today, it was, I forget who the ghost names were. He was fat, so I can't remember the other two. But One of the guys that got that was a guy named Joe Napoti, who I'd never heard of before, but I only know because...
Did a lot of voices.
Yeah, I only knew it because Brad was in that movie, and I saw the movie. And I can't remember there was a third guy, too, that was a voiceover comedic guy, but I can't remember who that was.
I auditioned for that, and I auditioned for the pig in Lion King.
Really?
Yeah. What was the pig's name? Was it...
I don't remember.
But that I did the pig, because the pig, you know, I do the thing in my act.
Right.
And they thought, somehow, they tied it in their head that, you know, he does a pig, he'd make a good pig.
I would love to do voiceover work at some point. It's just not, there's not a big market for it in Indianapolis. There's just not. And first time I ever did Bob and Tom was 2004. And when I finished my segment, Tom Griswold said to me, he's like, you have a really great speaking voice. And I hate my voice. I'm like, are you serious? And he's like, what, are you crazy? Yeah, it's amazing. And he's like, you should look into voiceover stuff. And of course, I've done nothing with it since then. It's been 12 years.
You haven't done anything?
No, I really have never done any of it.
Get out your computer, plug in a microphone, and just read.
Read copy?
Read copy. Just read ads that are in already in a magazine. Hey, you know.
Yeah, I need to do it.
These are two of the greatest things you'll ever put together.
But it's funny because I don't... Well, you and I talked about this a little bit. This is me. This is me off stage, and this is pretty much me on stage. I don't vary too much from this. Like, I did do... Okay, I got a commercial gig about 4 or 5, 6 years ago. And I'm looking in, of all places, the Craigslist is where I find it. And the ad says, looking for someone who is familiar with teleprompter work, someone who can do voices and dialects. I don't have any of that, so I applied. So I apply to it. They contact me. They bring me into their studio. And it's a small organization. And we start talking. And they said, you know, before we get going, anything you want to... You know, any questions you have? And I said, yeah. I said, I will say this. You said that you were looking for someone who is good with teleprompter. I went online. I went on to YouTube and I pulled a teleprompter feed from the Today Show to try to practice that.
Uh-huh.
I can't do it. I said, I cannot look like I'm engaged and not reading when I'm reading. It's just, I can't do it. And she goes, yeah, it's probably fine. We're not going to use the teleprompter. We kind of put that in there just as a way to kind of weed people out.
Yeah.
There's no teleprompter work, so it should be fine. She goes, anything else? I go, yeah. You also say you're looking for people to do voices and dialects, and I don't really do that either. Like, this is my voice, and this is what I do on everything. It's just not. And she's like, well, we actually like your voice, and we've seen we're fans of your comedy, so we'd like for you to do this. So I end up getting the job, despite the fact
you couldn't do anything.
I couldn't do any of
the
things. Yeah. And it worked out. And there's been other times where I've done that too. I got hired to be a moonshiner in a New Zealand commercial for this moonshine company in New Zealand. And they're like, we want you to be like a southern redneck. But it was called Indiana State Moonshine.
You're like, I can do that.
Yeah. Well, I had to send a video of me in character as my character's name was Sparkles. They made it up, not me.
So you were a gay moonshiner?
I think the reason they did it was at the time that show Moonshiners was really popular.
Uh-huh.
And there's a character named Tickle. And I think just it doesn't translate from the New Zealand market. So they just think a funny name is what it would be. So
right.
Sparkles.
Is Moonshiner not on or popular anymore?
I think it still is. But this is back when it was really, really big. So they wanted me to be a southern redneck. And I show up to do the shoot. And I was like... Do you guys, it's called Indiana State Moonshine. Do you want me to sound like a redneck or from Indiana? And they go like, oh, the way you talk is fine. That sounds southern enough. So I didn't have to do anything.
Didn't have to add anything. You didn't have to put on a little accent at all?
Nope. And in fact, they let me write all the dialogue. They let me, basically, I created the whole concept, which was awesome. But yeah, if I can like wing it on my own, I can do about anything.
Right.
But,
I have had this conversation about acting.
Because
I just did, I was... an extra in a movie just last week, but I was the glorified extra that got to like walk close.
Oh yeah, a little frame.
Yeah, you know, I was that. And so we were talking about extra, you know, to other people about acting. Have you done this? And you know, have you done this before? Like, yeah, you know, I took acting classes, and but what? I'm a performer. You're a performer. Mm-hmm. We do it every night.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm not good at is auditioning.
I agree.
I'm horrible. I'm terrible at auditioning. But tell me what you want me to do, and I can do it.
Yeah.
That was one of the things my acting teacher told me. He goes, you take direction better than most people I've ever seen. Like, just tell me what you want me to do. Do this. Done.
Right, right.
You know, but it's going in there and trying to do scenes with somebody.
I can't do it.
Well, you ever been in an audition where they're not actors?
It's the casting people.
It's a casting people. Yeah. They're just reading off the sheet. So what are you going to do when you get here? And you're supposed to turn the scene on?
Right.
Just tell me, put me in. Like Michael Madsen's. I read this article about Michael Madsen. He said he doesn't audition well. Just put him in the outfit, and you're playing.
Yeah.
You're actually playing. You're like you were a kid in the. Put on a cowboy hat and you're playing cowboys in your bedroom.
That makes total sense.
Just hire me and I will do it for you.
Right. I'm the same way. And I kind of struggle with like other people's words. Like if I can have some leeway on the script, I can make it better because I can say it the way I would say it and it won't sound so wooden, you know, and stiff. I'm definitely that way about things.
You're gonna get say it like we wrote it.
Right. Yeah.
Just say it like we wrote it.
The Coen brothers are gonna step in, but like I got called in. I don't audition well at all, and in fact, I get very very anxious when I do it. Mm-hmm. I'm very self conscious about stuff, so I get called to do a Goodwill commercial. So my commercial agent contacts me. He goes, "Hey, that's you need to wear a blue work shirt and jeans," and so I show up. There's 50 other guys that all look like me. You know,
isn't that amazing in an audition?
We're sitting in the audition room, and I'm sitting right by the room, the door that goes into the room where they're auditioning, right? And so I hear what the audition is, and it's some guy, and he runs into frame, and he picks up like a garbage can or something, and he screams something loud, and he throws it, and he's like, "This is crazy," and he runs off again. Yeah. And after like the fourth time hearing it, I go, "I don't want to fucking do that. I don't want to go in and do that. That's not me." So I just got up like I was going to the bathroom, and I just went to my car and left.
Didn't even
audition.
But you know you could have done that. You could have just, this is crazy.
I don't know that I could. I don't because I just don't let go like that. I don't allow myself to be goofy and over the top.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid of how it's going to look. Like it's not going to look natural.
Yeah.
So I just left, and then, and it was a pretty good payday if I would have gotten it. And my agent called me the next day. He goes, "Wait, what happened? They have you on the call sheet, but you never auditioned." And I was like, "Yeah, I got a phone call. I had to leave. Unfortunately, it was a last minute thing." He's like, "Oh, okay. Well, no problem. I know I wouldn't have gotten the thing."
You don't know that. One of the commercials that I auditioned for when I was living in L.A. was a Toyota commercial, and they wanted us to run between cars like you're looking in the windows, like you're looking in the interior. Right. One of the biggest sales of the year. You know, that kind of just run up to, and the camera would be inside the car and catch your face looking inside the. And I did the audition. I got a call back. And now you're supposed to, they change this thing. Okay, you're not just excited about it. Your tie gets caught in the window as it goes up. And you're gonna like make a face as it goes against the glass.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, all right, I'm good at this far. And you're trying to make all these, I'm smashed. Like you're not against glass, but you're trying to make faces like you're stuck against. And I ended up not getting that commercial. I guess I didn't pretend to have my face against the glass.
I wouldn't have gotten that commercial. There's no way. There's just no way. I get about 2% of what I audition for. If I happen to walk in and they're looking for me, then I get it. But if I probably should take some acting classes, to be honest. I probably should do that. I would probably enjoy doing that.
They are fun. The only thing bad about acting classes is being critiqued by people that aren't any good.
Yeah.
That is to me, and I don't mean this is a slam. If you're in acting class, good. You should always go there.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, sometimes when you just watch somebody else do a scene, and now it's your turn, and they're going to tell you what you did wrong, and you went, "You did the whole fucking scene wrong, dude." Right.
Yeah, I would not like that, for sure. But I think there's value in it, because I do want to do more of that stuff. You know, I'd like to do more roles and things like that.
I want to do a Western so bad. That's been my goal all my life. I mean, ever since I was a little kid, I've always wanted to be in a Western. I've always wanted to be that one that goes, "Let me shoot him, Paul. Can I shoot him, Paul? Let me just shoot him, Paul." You know, I mean, almost every Bonanza or Gunsmoke had the old man with three kids.
Yep.
"Let me just shoot him, Paul."
Yeah. God, that's great. A Western would be awesome. I got hired to be in a monster movie.
You did?
Yeah, I got hired to be in a remake of Attack of the Gila Monster. And I was cast. I get cast as a redneck a lot.
I don't know why.
I know. I get cast as this drunk redneck. And me and my...
It might be because you look like Otis Campbell.
Maybe.
I'm not just kidding.
Maybe. That's only when I'm weaving. So me and my scene partner, we're in this old, like, 50s Ford pickup. And we come upon the Gila Monster, and then it attacks us. And we have to, scream, and, like, we're in reverse.
Yeah.
And we're drunk. So I go do it, and it's really the first film I'd really done. And so I did this thing. And I felt like it went okay. You know, I mean, I'd certainly never worked with a green screen before. Yeah. So it was all pretty out of my comfort zone. And so the producer was like, hey, we're going to start editing this film together in probably about a month. If you want, you're welcome to come by and check out the editing process. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. So I reach out to him. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be home for a few weeks. I'd love to come by and see how it's coming. And he's like, oh, yeah, Matt, I'm glad you called. I need to talk to you about a couple of things. I go, oh, what's that? He goes, well, we're not going to be able to use the scene that we filmed with you. And I go, oh, okay. So, well, was there like a problem with the take? Do you need to redo it? And he's like, look, I like you. And it wasn't good. It just wasn't. When we looked at it on film, it just wasn't good. Because now, to be fair, the guy who was in the scene with you didn't do you any favors at all. Like, he was really clunking it up. I go, oh, so are you just not going to, you just cutting that scene out or what?
And he's like, we'll reshoot it.
He goes, no, we're going to recast and reshoot it.
Man.
And I go, oh, okay. And I go, do I still get to keep the money? And he's like, oh, yeah. And I go, oh, I don't care what you do. That's fine. I don't care. So I'm not in this movie that's terrible. Okay.
Yeah.
But so that's been like a theme for me. It's like, it's not making the final cut.
The two movies that I've actually been involved with. One was Ford Fairlane.
Okay.
With Andrew Dice Clay. Yep. Remember that?
Yep.
I played a roadie in that movie when they were... It was a concert scene. I don't know if you remember the movie at all. It starts off with a concert scene.
Yeah, I know.
And the murder takes place in that. And
so you're that. So you're the roadie in that?
I was the roadie on stage, but I got cut out. From the shots, this was an all-day thing. Push this over there. Stand over there.
Right.
You know, react to the, you know.
And you managed to get none of that.
None of it. I got none of that. So that didn't make it at all. And then there was another movie called Six Pennies and a Handgun. Right. And the movie was about a guy that he reads about near-death experience. People have near-death experiences, come back, like they enjoy life again.
Right.
They're so depressed, but they have a near-death, so they come back. So basically, he's going to try to commit blue suicide. He's going to try to have the cops...
Oh, shoot him.
Shoot him.
Okay.
And have a near-death. That's what... He's down to six pennies. That's what... One of the scenes... That's all he has in his hand is six, and he's like, makes this decision. Huh. But there's more to it than that, but that's the thing. Well, I play this... Southern gun dealer. I play the guy that he comes to buy it.
Yeah.
Can you see it?
Yeah, I mean, totally.
And the guy with the film, the scene went great. Even the sound guy went, he goes, wow, that was great. You know, the sound guy goes, wow, that was, you were, are you stage trained? Like that. I go, kind of, you know, stand up. And the movie, I read about it in Playboy, because one of the stars was a Playboy bunny.
Oh.
It was going to be one of her first film.
Okay.
So it was written about in Playboy.
Nice.
Never got released.
Oh, God.
Never got released at all.
That's terrible.
So my two, like, okay. And so I sort of gave up for it a long time. Like, but maybe that's not for me. I'll just stick to stand-up. I know what I'm good at. I'll do that. But as we were just talking earlier, that's the only shit that will take you to the next level. You have to do something to take you to the next level.
No, you really have to. And now today, it's more like finding some way for something to go viral. You know, that's kind of the key now for most people. But like six years ago, I was going to move to L.A. That was my plan. Me and a buddy, we're going to move out. We ended up not doing it, basically because Carnival at the time, I was working Carnival. And
Carnival Cruises.
Yeah, and they made it clear to me that flying me from Burbank to like
Miami.
Fort Lauderdale or whatever was not going to be advantageous to them, and I would actually get less work because they'd have to overnight me to get me in town early enough to do that. And the West Coast Carnival Cruise stuff is already locked up by a group of already, you know, comics that have that.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't break into that. So when I realized I was going to lose that much work that paid well, I was like, well, I'm not going to go to L.A. then. Because I had no work lined up in L.A. Mm-hmm. Really, I hadn't had a place to live yet.
You just knew that L.A. is where you're supposed to go. Right. If you want to take it to the next level.
And realistically, I probably should have gone at that time. I should have gone to New York. I'd probably be a better fit in New York than I would be L.A.
With your stories.
Yeah, just my attitude and everything else. But, and also,
80 y'all could leave and it wouldn't
be. And my age, too. I mean, I'm in my 40s, so L.A. is not going to be friendly to me. But if I went to New York, I'd have to start over.
Right.
And I'm not, I've invested way too much. I have a pretty good career right now that's building. To start over makes no sense to
me. Like we were talking last night, you actually, you're making money.
Yeah.
You're paying your bills and you have a little money in the bank.
Yeah.
That is America right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I quit my day job, when I quit my corporate job to do this, and actually that's kind of an interesting story if you want to hear that. I was on the road somewhere in Michigan doing a show, and I went to see the movie Up in the Air with George Clooney.
Uh-huh, love that movie.
Okay. So in that movie, there's a scene where they're firing J.K. Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that scene?
Yeah.
And Clooney asks, he's like, well, what am I supposed to tell my family? You know, I just lost my job. Unemployment only pays me so much or whatever. And Clooney said, well, what about cooking? He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, you have a minor in culinary arts. You know, when were you going to go back to what makes you happy? And he goes, let me ask you a question. How much did they first pay you to give up on your dreams? And he goes, $27,000. And he goes, isn't it time to go back to what you're really happy, what makes you happy?
Yeah.
That scene in the movie hit me like a ton of bricks.
Because she's like, I need to do what makes me happy.
Yeah. And
I've always wanted to do comedy.
Right. And I'd been doing it to that point for years, and I was still working a day job. And I didn't even, honest to God, the rest of the movie just blacked out to me. And I had to go back to see the movie.
Because that scene spoke to you.
Yeah, and I sat there until the theater, the screen was gray, you know, snow, and the usher had to come and go, hey, man, we got to clean. They had to throw me out because I was just mesmerized. So fast forward to 6 months later when that movie gets released on, like, Showtime or whatever it was. Well, at the time I worked for the cable company, that was my last corporate job, and I would sleep with my TV on at night. Three different times, I woke up to that exact scene.
Ooh.
And the third time I went in, I put my notice in. I'm like, I'm done.
As you should.
I put my notice in, and then I was making good money. I had no money in the bank, which means I was shitty with money at the time. It wasn't like I had 3 months' salary or 6 months' salary.
And I've stored up, and now I'm going to pay this while I work.
No, none of that. I just stopped. On this date, I stopped getting paid, and then comedy paid everything from that point on, and I've never missed a payment.
Oh, wow.
So.
Well, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. I've got some more questions for you.
Okay.
I got questions.
Oh, God.
And we'll move that right after this. All right, and we're back. I got a couple regular questions that I like to ask people now and then. And so this is your questions.
Okay.
What's the worst thing you've ever eaten?
Ooh. Oh, my God. Let me think. I've always been a pretty picky eater. So there are things I don't like.
At all?
Yeah. Like I have like four things on my list that I just don't eat. It's my number one thing. The number one thing I do not ever eat are eggs. I hate them.
Why?
I think it's a texture thing. I'm not sure.
Eggs are one of my favorite things in the world.
I have this discussion with everybody. Eggs, mushrooms, mayonnaise.
What?
And beans.
What?
Yeah.
You can never be British.
No, I can never have a British breakfast ever, ever.
Full English breakfast.
Yeah, couldn't do
eggs,
it.
Eggs, beans.
Yep, couldn't do it. So probably, man.
Did you eat anything weird? Like maybe I'll help you down there. When you were on the ships, was there anything like when the aisle, did you go to a country, they went, I'm not eating
it. I remember one time I was really hungry and they would not let us go above board because it was a overly busy cruise and it was a sea day. We had to eat in the crew mess and it was some fish that had the head still on it, like smelt, I think.
Yeah.
And it was just with weird shit mixed in, and I was like, I gotta eat something.
Yeah, because a lot of times those crew rooms, I've noticed, those crew cooks make stuff for the foreign workers.
Yes, the ethnicity
of the worker. And you're like, ooh, I'm not eating
so
that.
So I ate some pretty weird shit there. I don't even know what it was, but it was probably smelt with weird goo and...
Yeah. But, well, what's the most illegal thing you've ever done?
Oh, man. Never been a drug user, so really nothing like that. I've shoplifted. I've trespassed. I've never killed anyone, obviously.
Oh, good, good. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, that
you kill on stage, but that's different.
That's true. I had a company that I worked for years ago. No, it wasn't illegal. I can't even say that. I probably steal or probably shoplift or something.
Yeah. Was it something major or was it just like?
I used to go into Walmart and change prices on shit.
Did you?
Yeah, I'd go into Walmart and I would never do that to Target or whatever. But Walmart's a terrible company, and so I would go in and I would go to the clearance stuff and I'd pull and they never had the tags pressed all the way.
Yeah.
And I'd pull the clearance tag off and like if I wanted. This, you know.
I got a pair of jeans for a dollar.
Yeah. I put the clearance thing on, and then it would ring up, and you have to be a good actor to pull it. Maybe I am a good actor, because it'd scan at the regular price. I'm like, whoa, that's clearance. That's on clearance. And then I show them the tag, and they're like, oh, okay. Like, you could literally go to someone in Walmart and say, hey, you can't, this price is wrong. And they're like, oh.
I used to do a bit, and you reminded me, I haven't done this in a really long time. One of the things that I used to like about Walmart is you could take Anything back.
Yeah.
I mean, you could find an empty box on the side of the highway and go, look, when I got home, this was empty.
You could return a Kohl's gift card to Walmart probably and get the cash.
Yeah.
Oh, here's one thing I did do. This is another Walmart thing. I did walk into Walmart and I feel there was something that set this up too. I got screwed on something. And I went in and those electric toothbrushes, the really nice ones.
Uh-huh.
I went in and got one of those, and then I walked up to the return counter with it and said, I need to return this. I don't have a receipt, though. And they're like, okay. And they returned
You returned
it.
Something from
An
the
item
store.
From their store. I walked in, got it off the shelf, and went to the return. Oh. So I'd say that's pretty illegal.
That's pretty illegal.
Yeah.
I hope it was 7 years ago. I mean, I don't know what the window of...
It probably was 7 years ago. Okay, good. Probably 10 years
ago. No, but I had heard about something like that. I heard about people that would take sacks, like Walmart bags, put them in their pocket, and walk around and get a dress or a bra. These women were talking about this.
Yeah.
And that they would put them in the bag and go around and go, I got this as a gift, and I need to...
Well, my second wife, she was bad about buying stuff and not returning it. Like we'd be in a store, like Kohl's was her big one. We'd be in a Kohl's and she's like, "You like this sweater?" And she'd hold it up. I mean, it's fine. She's like, "I'm gonna buy this." I'm like, "That's not your size." "Oh, I know, they don't have my size, but it's on sale, so I'm gonna buy it now, and then when they restock it, I'm gonna return it for my size." I'm like, "That's a lot of moving parts. Let's just
skip on that."
But she would do it anyway. So we, at any given time, we'd have bags and bags of stuff to be returned to Kohl's because she was never good about doing it. So finally, one day, I just hit my breaking point. I'm like, you know what? This is ending today. I'm taking all this shit back to Kohl's. And I literally had bags of stuff. Some of the stuff was 3 years old.
When you came in, did they say, why do you have all this?
Well, that was the thing. It's a guy with like 9 bags of merchandise, and I have receipts for everything.
Yeah.
And as long as you have a receipt, they're cool with it. So they're returning everything, and I'm, like, embarrassed, you know? So one of the items was 3 years old. It was a sweater, right?
Because she was going to get the real size.
It was like a sweater or a sweatshirt, and it had, like, it was weird. It had, like, a pony on it. I can't remember, like, a little horse. I don't know if it was embroidered or what it was, but it was odd. And the agent, she's trying to scan it, and the receipt is so old, it won't scan. So she plugs it in on her manually. She comes back and she goes, okay. She goes, this item? She goes, this is 3 years old. And I go, I know. And then real quickly, I go, you know what? It was my aunt had passed away. And when we went to clean out her house, we found all this stuff we'd bought her over the years that she never even used.
Yeah.
So we just, and she's like, oh, it's no problem. Of course we can do this.
Oh, great story.
So she, yeah.
Improv.
Like that. Like that. So... Yeah, because the real story is my wife's insane. And
ex-wife.
Yeah, ex-wife. Well, at the time, wife. But so they punch this in, and she goes, all right. She goes, this item is on clearance. It's been clearance several times. It's like $1.98 is the value. And I go, yep, but I have the receipt. And she goes, I know. She goes, so what I can do is I can give you the full price, but I have to do it as a store credit card, like a gift card. And yeah. I go, well, that's fine. Because I'm thinking, I just returned $1,200 worth of shit. I'm pretty sure she's coming back.
She will be back.
I go, no problem. So I take it and I get home and I have all the paperwork. And I go, here you go. And she goes, what is this? I go, I returned all that stuff. And so she's going through it like a mafia accountant. She's looking at all the receipts and everything. And then all of a sudden she comes on this gift card. She goes, what is this? I go, it's a store credit. You have that sweatshirt that it was like 3 years old and it wouldn't scan. And it was on clearance. And so they gave me a store credit. And she's like, well, I wish you would have called me. Because I go, what's the big deal? And she goes, well, I just would have kept it. I go, it's a store credit. You're going to be fine.
It's money.
Yeah,
it is money.
It's the same as money. Yeah. And she's like, well, I just would have kept it. I mean, it was 3 years old. And she's like, well, but still. And I'm like, it had a pony on it. What do you want this for? Like, you're insane. And I never returned anything for her again. And it literally was sad.
Was that the start of the downfall of
your... No, it was during the downfall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, man, I just lost my... There it is. I lost my question. All right. What is the first album you ever bought?
Ooh, that would have been my first album. Would have been probably Sammy Hagar, Voice of America. Yeah,
you're a Hagar fan, huh?
Well, I wasn't until I saw him live. I saw him live before Van Halen. Mm-hmm. Crocus was his opening act, and other than well, there's been a few since that have been better. It was one of the best live shows I ever saw. It was pretty remarkable.
If you had a superpower,
mm-hmm.
what would it be?
I think it'd be to fly. I think that's I'd want to fly, just because we spend so much time on the road. It'd be nice just to, where am I going? Okay, whoosh, go.
Just walk out the door of the next con.
Whoosh. I'd love that. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'd make one up. I think it'd be flying.
That's pretty cool. Tell one amazing thing that we don't know about you. One amazing thing.
Oh, man. God, I'm not very good at that.
No?
I can tell you a story that I think is amazing, but it'll sound like I'm tooting my horn. I'm not trying to. When I went through I went through a downsizing with a company early on in my career, long before I did comedy.
Uh-huh.
And come to find out, I was not the person that was scheduled for this downsize. It was somebody else. The person who was scheduled to get the downsize was older than me. He was in his 40s, married, had 3 kids. His wife did not work. If he would have lost his job, it would have devastated his entire life.
His life.
It'd been over. I, on the other hand, was 29 years old.
Yeah.
Had 12 years with a major corporation.
What, did you throw yourself on the sword kind of thing?
Yeah, I drove to our corporate offices and I went to my general manager or our district manager and I was like, I'll volunteer to take the downsize. And she's like, why would you do that? And I explained it. I'm like, well, look, this is really not that big of a thing to me. I can recover for this. I'm not even 30. I've got 12 years with this company. I'm pretty marketable. I can go get other work. On the flip side, this would devastate this guy in his life. And she was like, oh, okay. And so I got my termination package, which was, I got like 26 weeks pay or something out of it or whatever. And I moved on. To this day, he doesn't know that happened.
You know, this just made you a really good person. You know what? That just negated all your, I'm taking stuff back. I put a cheaper tag on something. Yeah. That just...
Yeah.
God, your salvation is amazing.
Well, it's just, you know, my dad worked for Chrysler his whole, up to the day he died, he was working in a factory. My mom worked multiple jobs. If my parents would have lost any of their jobs, we'd have been screwed.
Yeah.
So I really pay attention to that stuff. And for me, I was going on my next adventure. And it was like, I can do this. And I felt good about it. And like, it's not a self-serving name because I never told him that it happened. No one other than me, and if anyone listens to this that maybe knows me from that period, you know now.
Yeah.
But no one knows because that was the thing. I was like, just say that it was, you can say it was performance, that my performance was bad.
Wow.
I don't care.
Wow. Well, let's take you back to the dark side.
Okay.
With one more question.
Okay.
If you could throw one person, one famous person off of, whether it's music, TV, whatever, if you get the one famous person into a pit of lions, who would it be?
God, who would I do that to? I only get one.
One famous person. There's got to be somebody.
Oh, there's a bunch. I'm just trying to rank.
Trying them. To narrow it down to who would you really like to... It was, okay, is lions too much? Would you just like to vote them off the island? Or who would...
Man.
Which choice you want? Do you want to just vote them off the island? Or would you like to throw
them? I like the lions.
Okay.
Yeah, I want this to be permanent. Man, there's a bunch. There's different
people for different reasons.
Yeah, and there's different levels of people. Like there are people I've worked with that I would do it, but I won't name names on something like that. But
I get a lot of Kardashian.
Yeah,
that's what I get when I.
Yeah, and I get that too. It's almost not their fault though. They were created by society. There are certainly a lot of times I'd toss Bono.
Oh, there you go. There's your answer.
Yeah,
Bono.
He's real self-serving. So I'd say Bono, because I appreciate what he does, but man, he needs to shut up. He really needs to shut up. He's just a blowhard. Maybe John Mellencamp too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably both of them.
Because Mellencamp's one of your Indiana boys, isn't he?
He is, but he's just not a good person.
No.
Yeah, so that's probably what I do. I'd probably do Mellencamp.
Well, you have been a great person on the podcast.
Well, I appreciate being on the podcast.
I love it. Now, tell people how to find you. How do people discover Matt Holt?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Holt Comedy. I'm on Facebook. My website, which should be down right now, is...
you have one of the shittiest websites.
It's not good.
I mean, I'm not saying that because I've been there. I'm saying that because you told me that.
Right. my website needs to be redone. If anyone wants to take care of that, you can contact me. But it's mattholtcomedy.com. So yeah, and you can just get me that way. But I'm trying to do more on Twitter. So
are you on Facebook?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Got Twitter. Vine. Let's go through
No Vine.
Periscope.
Nope.
Snapchat.
I'm not active in it.
Instagram.
Instagram. I have an account. Yes.
Okay.
And it's Holt Comedy.
So you really need to up your social media game.
Yeah, I do.
All right. So anybody listening, if you can help him up his social media game.
And the thing is, like, I love Instagram, but it's one of those things I don't think to take pictures of stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think to take pictures unless I'm, like, somewhere cool where there's cool architecture or whatever, and I'll take it and I'll filter it and do all that stuff. But it's not my first thought, and I need to get better about that.
Now, my girlfriend and I, Janet, we do a podcast together called Wrinkled Sheets.
Okay.
And we have a YouTube channel called Wrinkled Sheets.
Okay.
And we try to do daily vlogs.
Okay.
And I end up doing more vlogging than her because she goes, oh, I forgot. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should have. Oh, that was something cool you did. Yeah, I guess I should have vlogged that. Yes. And part of remembering social media is remembering
to do it. Yeah.
To do it, you know.
And that's for me too, because, like, you know how it is. On the road, you have all this downtime.
Yeah.
And it's not like I don't have the time to do it.
Right.
I just have to allocate the time to do it. And it'll be fine. Like, I've got a lot of projects I want to do, and I just don't make the time to do them.
Right. And I probably am the opposite of this, because I let social media consume me. Like, you know, I have 100,000 followers on Twitter, and I've got 10,000 people on Facebook. And my Instagram, I got 2,000 or whatever on Snapchat. So I have to work these. I really do feel like I need to work.
No, you do have to. You absolutely have to.
But then at the same time, I'll go, well, crap, I've done this all day, and I didn't get around to doing what I really, you know. I should have cut the grass today, but I was busy doing this.
There's probably a middle ground somewhere, and I'm not even close to the middle ground. I have 1,500 Twitter followers. You know, and I know those are solid followers. They're following me, and they're not robots or whatever. But I just need to, like... I just need to get more aggressive about it.
Yeah,
that's my goal.
My technique of working Twitter was to follow back. I'm a big follow back person.
Mm-hmm.
And hashtag follow back or anything that says team follow back.
Okay.
So if somebody follows me, I will follow back. And people always go, well, you follow like 80,000 people. I know, because that's how you actually grow. It's social. It's being, like, a lot of times people will go, or my girlfriend will tell me too, well, I don't know them. Well, I don't know these people either.
Right.
That's part of what
right, that's
being
what you're
social
right.
is.
That's
you know?
True. Well, I'll get there.
And you will. And you will. And a matter of fact, I'm enjoying the heck out of doing the shows with you this week here.
It's been fun.
At Looney Bin, Wichita.
Yes.
And we will do this again. Ladies and gentlemen, how about a fake air applause?
Ooh, I like that.
For Matt Holt, everybody.
Thanks for having me,
You're
Steve.
Welcome. So until next time, God bless America. Go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys.
Mm.
I bid you adieu.
And trucks and stooges three men and boys, and that doesn't sound right. He thinks about booze and bacon and power tools. Come with me, let your mask you leave. Oh, won't you come with me and remask you leave?
Aloha.